Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
It's really a vegetable soup, and you use beef and chicken and all the vegetables, like your corn and green beans and your peas.
Sounds pretty typical, but add turtle and you have a Southern Indiana delicacy. Traditional Arts Indiana talks to cooks and restaurant owners to learn about the tradition of turtle soup. Farmers are anticipating a future with more frequent droughts. How growers are adapting to growing food with less water, a story from Harvest Public Media. Daniel Orr's garden is thriving. He picks some okra and serves it up raw. That's right, not deep fried. And taste your way through Big Red Eats Green, an event on the Indiana University campus where students rub elbows with restaurants serving up local fare. News of the Week, brought to us by Luann Johnson.
In the days following Tokyo's successful bid for the 2020 Summer Olympics, scrutiny has fallen on the safety of Japan's fish exports. South Korea announced it has banned fish imports from the Fukushima region over concerns of radiation levels. Water used to cool nuclear reactors leaked in July, prompting fears of contamination. South Korea isn't the only country to ban food from Fukushima. China has held a ban in place for dairy, vegetables, and seafood from the region since the meltdown in 2011. According to a government report issued last week, the USDA used outdated data and sloppy procedures to test controversial proposed changes in the way the country inspects poultry. The Government Accountability Office reported that the agency had not considered enough data from its 10-year pilot project and had failed to adequately demonstrate some claims it used in promoting the new methods. Three pilot projects were launched in 1998 to test new inspection procedures that the USDA says are long overdue. But critics complain the changes would only mean faster, more dangerous production lines, allow industry inspectors to take over positions held by government inspectors, and drastically reduce the number of inspectors. In a letter responding to the audit, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand said the agency's study was, quote, deeply flawed and had significant limitations, and called for proposed rules based on the USDA pilot program to be suspended because the proposed changes were, quote, not formulated on a strong scientific basis and assumptions made in the proposed rule may not be correct. The GAO recommended that the USDA publicly disclose all the weaknesses in its assessment. The USDA has agreed to comply with the disclosure recommendations. And, as if bees need any more hazards to worry about, now add fungicides to the list of culprits for so-called colony collapse disorder. A growing body of evidence shows a matrix of factors, not just one particular chemical or disease, is to blame for massive bee deaths in Europe and North America over the last few years. Research released last month showed for the first time that fungicides appear to increase a bee's susceptibility to a virulent gut parasite called Nosema, one of the many diseases linked to colony collapses. Researchers tested bees exposed to pollen that was gathered near crops like blueberries, cucumbers, and watermelon, and detected 35 different pesticides, including high levels of fungicides. The latter turned out to be a significant risk factor in bees that suffered from Nosema. Significantly, the same study looked at real-world doses of pesticides in the bees they studied, rather than exposing bees to arbitrary amounts of a single compound that might not reflect exposure in the field. Critics have slammed previous studies on pesticides for using doses higher than bees would normally encounter. Read more about these stories on our website, eartheats.org. Chad Bouchard and Liz Leslie are filing stories there throughout the week.
And get the latest food news 24/7 on Twitter and Facebook. Search for Earth Eats and join the conversation. Our headlines today read by Luann Johnson. Always a pleasure.
See you next week.
The future of agriculture across the Great Plains hinges on water. Without it, nothing can grow. Climate models and population growth paint a pretty bleak picture for water availability a few decades from now. If farmers want to stay in business, they have to figure out how to do more with less. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports from Colorado.
There's chemical smell in here, so Rod Weimer opens the door to the control room of what he calls the Cadillac of irrigation systems. He's the farm manager for Fagerberg Produce in Weld County, Colorado, one of the largest producers of onions in the country.
It was about water savings and quality.
Crimson-colored cisterns line one wall of the building. A control panel glows on the other side. This sophisticated setup filters water pumped from both underground reservoirs and from canals that divert water from nearby rivers. It's then pushed out into the onion fields through underground plastic piping.
It's kind of like a big sprinkler system in your yard.
This system is a textbook example of drip irrigation, much more tech-savvy than old-school methods, which flood fields with water. Weimer can irrigate 900 acres of onions with the push of a button on his smartphone. The plastic piping is so precise, the farm uses 30% less water than it did before this system was installed. It cost about $4,000 an acre, and last year, it paid off.
And on dry years, you know, you may think you have a lot of water, but if you don't get water in the mountains, you're not going to get all your water. So that's what this is all about.
We're working on a corn sunflower rotation at the moment.
Tom Trout pilots a four-wheeler through row after row of bright yellow sunflowers. He's a USDA researcher with a mandate.
What we're trying to figure out is how to continue to get good yields with less water.
Not an easy task. Crops need water. When you cut back too much, they don't grow as well. But if you can find the sweet spot where plants are getting just as much water as they need at exactly the right times, all of a sudden you free up lots of extra water.
It's like getting our bodies used to eating less food, for example, and creating a new equilibrium for ourselves.
The stakes are high to figure this out. Trout says in the most arid regions of the plains, farmers are already overdrawing underground sources. Development is encroaching, and climate models show precipitation will become much more variable.
So all those things are kind of coming together for a perfect storm, and meaning we're going to have less water to work with in the future.
Farmers are probably better at conserving water than the average homeowner because it's a big economic issue to them.
That's Brian Werner, a spokesman for Northern Water, one of Colorado's largest water distribution systems. He says even when farmers switch to more efficient irrigation, it's not an easy task to figure out who gets the extras. Colorado's Byzantine water law can be difficult to navigate, and as long as farmers still have water now, there's little incentive to make a switch.
We're getting there, I think, the mindset. The paradigm is shifting, however, maybe so slowly, towards how we get to that point.
That shift is happening. Between 2003 and 2008, about 800,000 acres of U.S. farmland were equipped with more efficient systems. But these new systems won't likely be a panacea to the looming water shortages. A study of irrigated land in western Kansas found that when farmers change their irrigation systems, they switch crops to ones that require more water and bring in more money. That switch sometimes negates the entire water savings. Back at Fagerberg Produce in Weld County, farm manager Rod Weimer says he has no regrets about installing drip irrigation. He's using less water, and the quality of his onion crop only gets better.
If we want to survive, that's what we're going to have to do. It's not cheap, but in the long run, it's going to pay off.
And Weimer says surviving means doing more with less. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media at harvestpublicmedia.org. The small towns that dot the rural landscape of southern Indiana are well known for turtle soup, a culinary oddity that seems more fitting in the coastal swamplands of Louisiana than the uplands of southern Indiana. So, how did turtle soup wind up in the Ohio River Valley? Betsy Shepherd and the Traditional Arts Indiana crew planned a pub crawl of the taverns and cafes to find out about turtle soup's regional foothold. She begins a conversation with Dale Hentrip of DuBois County, Indiana.
Dale doesn't know where turtle soup first got its start, but theorizes that it was originally made for practical reasons. People would fry the turtle to eat and then make soup from the discarded parts.
Years ago, everybody was poor, and you didn't throw anything away. You fried the turtle, like the legs and the neck and stuff, but you cooked the backs. and that's what you made the soup out of.
Though its exact origin remains unknown, the soup, like so many traditional dishes, first started out as an experimental mixing of local goods. Dale describes the dish by listing all of the ingredients that go into it.
Turtle soup, you use like turtle meat in it, but you also use beef bones or beef roast and an old baking hen, and you cook, you know, the meat and you debone it all, and you save the broth, then you just add your vegetables and all the stuff like that to it. You take pickling spice, you put it in a cheesecloth and cook it in there with it, but you don't want it to break and get into the soup. You're just using it for the flavor. It's like any recipe, and everybody changes it a little bit to their liking, you know.
Yes, everybody has their own version. Here is Julie Moore, cook and waitress at Flags Cafe in Ferdinand, Indiana, for over 40 years, listing the ingredients she uses.
It's really a vegetable soup, and you use beef and chicken and all the vegetables, like your corn and green beans and your peas and your carrots and your celery and onions and cabbage. And, of course, you have to use some pickling spice. You season with salt and pepper and your chili powder.
With descriptions like that, we decided to defer to our taste buds on the matter. But when we sidled up to the cafe counters and bar tops, asking for a bowl teeming with turtle, we were greeted with this disclaimer.
It's actually a mock turtle soup, and we use beef instead of turtle in the soup.
They call it mock turtle soup.
Considered mock turtle soup, but the flavor still stays the same.
We used to use turtle all the time, but now you cannot use turtle unless you buy government-inspected turtle. So we usually just make ours with beef and chicken.
Turtle soup's simple name belies the many ingredients used to make it. And turtle meat, the one thing you'd expect to find in the soup, is missing from the list. Government bans on wild game make turtle meat unaffordable for most mom-and-pop operations. Therefore, turtle soup from restaurant vendors is turtle soup in name only. Mock turtle soup, however, has its own storied past. Its origins extend back to mid-18th century England, where it was popularized as a cheap alternative to the delicacy green turtle soup and was made legendary by Lewis Carroll's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. In spite of its name, Indiana mock turtle soup isn't seen as inferior to its amphibious archetype. Richard Helming and Rob Kitten, the former owner and current owner of Flags Cafe, maintain the difference in taste is negligible.
It's not got no turtle in it, but I said it's pretty good, and they try it, and they like it. I said it is pretty
yeah,
good.
Yeah, it really don't put any different flavor to the taste of it at all, the turtle don't.
Even Dale, who cooks turtle soup from turtles he catches himself, which is permitted so long as he doesn't sell the meat, says that turtles don't make that much difference in the way of taste.
Cooked turtle, it's got a bland taste, or it's not really a taste to it.
Now convinced that we'd still be getting our money's worth without the turtle meat, we put in our first order of soup at Heichelbeck's in Jasper, Indiana.
Okay, so it looks like a vegetable soup, right? Does it have cheese in it?
No, it's spaghetti.
Oh, spaghetti. And then maybe a little, it kind of looks a little like stew.
Sweet and spicy.
Mm-hmm.
After relocating to the Ferdy Flyer, a local cafe named after the town's old train station, we were surprised by the variety in taste.
Looks like chicken and beef.
I think it's chicken and beef. Why don't you ask Darlene? And it's got like a fettuccine noodles in it, and peas and green beans.
It's really interesting seeing the local varieties of it. Because this, I mean, not only does it taste a lot different, but it looks like a totally different soup. From what I can tell, the main consistency in turtle soup is the pickling spice.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not the turtle.
According to most, the meat is simply a conduit for the real flavor, which comes from pickling spices. Here again is Richard from Flags talking about his preferred technique for spicing things up.
And what I do is I'll take the paddle and squeeze it against the side of the pot so that the juices in the spice bag get in the soup, yeah.
Richard mentioned stirring the soup with a paddle. The paddle is used to stir the soup in a 15-gallon cast iron pot. Because of the soup's popularity and the elaborate process of making it, cooks traditionally make the soup in huge portions. Turtle soup provides the people of southern Indiana with a shared sense of community Dale tells about how his relationship with Larry Bird warmed over a hot bowl of turtle.
Do you know Larry Bird by any chance?
The basketball player?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, he's a real good friend of mine. He's about like all of us old guys, getting high blood pressure, and the doctor advises, you know, to stay away from the salt, you know. So I made some turtle soup and took it up to his house. He lived in French Lick, Indiana, which this has been about, oh, God, 10, 12 years ago. And I took him some turtle soup, and he'd come down to my lake property, comes down and drinks beer with me sometimes, and I asked him how he liked the soup. He said, boy, it was good, but man, it was a little salty.
After making our rounds, chatting up the good folks at headquarters in Heichelbeck's in Jasper and the Fruity Flyer and Flags Cafe in Ferdinand, it was time to say our farewells. While we were walking to the car, a generous local chased us down and offered us a tub of homemade soup with real turtle in it. He explained that though the soup can't be commercially bought or sold, it is still made at home and shared among friends.
Hear about more Hoosier food traditions from Betsy Shepherd at traditionalartsindiana.org. Coming up,
If we made, say, the honey ice cream with conventional eggs, then it would be kind of a weird, it wouldn't be as bright. Our honey ice cream is like a golden yellow, and it's really pretty.
Dominique Weberhunt of Blue Boy is serving up ice cream sandwiches at Big Red Eats Green. Tastes great, refreshing on a hot day, and local through and through. More from Big Red Eats Green coming up. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Every fall, a new batch of students descends on Bloomington, Indiana, and every fall, campus organizers throw a big local food party to introduce new folks to all the food options unique to the community. This year, Big Red Eats Green featured three local growers and 15 restaurants that use local products in their food. For a small price, students walking to and from classes could try a burrito from Laughing Planet or a cupcake from Rainbow Bakery. Earth Eats was there, and we bring you this postcard.
Good food and drink straight ahead, locally grown and operated. Take a look, guys. Stop in. Locally
We're at Big grown. Red Eats Green. It's on IU campus by the Art Museum. My name's Lindsay Taylor. I work for Soma Coffee House and Juice Bar. Today we're doing the Berry Berry Good, which is blueberries, strawberries, bananas, and raspberries, as well as the Farm Boy Tim, which has melons.
I got a Farm Boy Tim. Let's see. It's got blueberries, peaches, rhubarb, honeydew, and cantaloupe.
Do you know Soma's smoothies?
I do. They are downtown across from my church, and I go there all the time.
I'm Dorothy Granger. I have a business with Julie Thomas. It's called Bloomington Flower Power.
F-L-O-U-R.
Yes, ma'am. We are purveyors of fine handmade pastas. So we use local ingredients. For example, I love it. The basil's from my garden. We use squash from the farmer's market or spinach from farmer's market.
For examples?
For example, I'm listening to Boulay and Greek vegetable wraps.
Free wrap?
Getting towards the end of the afternoon, and I don't want to take it back with me. And plus, it gives everybody a chance to sample it and try it.
Free wrap?
Oh, I will. I will. All right, I
there
will.
You go.
Thank you, sir.
Talk to a real-life farmer right here, folks.
Did I catch you in a moment on the soapbox or something?
I'm kind of on a soapbox. Yeah.
And tell me why. Students, why should they buy local?
They should buy local because it's better for you and better for the planet. My name is Jonas Carpenter. I'm with Bread and Roses Nursery.
And I'm Salem Willard, and I'm also with Bread and Roses Nursery. You know, we don't exactly have the sexiest booth here, all those sorrel and chives. I mean, how can you resist? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're just spreading the word.
For example?
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Have a good afternoon, okay?
So Christine Barber, who's a professor at IU, said, okay, my one goal for today is get a Blue Boy ice cream sandwich. I have to get it. What's so great about these?
First off, the chocolate chip cookies are amazing. We roll them in cinnamon sugar and sprinkle them with sea salt. And then we use local honey ice cream. So the honey is from Hunter's Honey Farm. The eggs are from Poplar Ridge Farm. And if we made, say, the honey ice cream with conventional eggs, then it would be kind of a weird... It wouldn't be as bright. Our honey ice cream is like a golden yellow, and it's really pretty.
My name is Dominique Weberhunt. I am the pastry chef and the COO.
What are you buying?
I'm buying a chocolate chip cookie.
Have you had Blue Boy before?
I have never had it. No. So I'm excited.
Yeah. Well, do
your thing. Oh, let me try it. Pretty good. I'm digging it.
I am selling vegan donuts and vegan cupcakes. My name is Lisa Dorazeski from Rainbow Bakery. I would probably recommend the salted caramel cupcake. It's the most decadent, but also the... It pleases everyone, I feel like, you know, because it's pretty basic but also has a nice pop of flavor.
And why is it important for you guys to be here today?
Well, we're a new business in town, and we wanted to get out and let the students know that we're here and just be involved with all of these people that are like-minded.
For this community to thrive, we need entrepreneurs, people coming in with ideas for new businesses. And if we support these local businesses, then the money stays here in the community.
See photos of Big Red Eats Green on the web, eartheats.org. One recipe today to get you thinking before your next meal. Okra is a member of the hibiscus family, so the plant produces one of the most beautiful blooms in the vegetable garden. The fruit of the plant is often deep-fried or stewed. But Chef Daniel Orr rarely cooks what's typical. How about a raw okra salad?
And we have to keep these nets on them so the deers don't eat them.
Oh, do deer like okra? He's grabbing the necessary ingredients from his garden.
Well, today we are back at the Orr Homestead, Columbus, Indiana, and we're going to pick some okra. Now, what do you think about okra?
I love deep-fried okra.
Uh-huh. And what do you think of, like, stewed okra? Have you ever had
Never
that?
Never had it. Is that what you're making for me today?
No, that actually, a lot of people don't like that. Everyone likes fried okra.
Yeah,
everybody likes everything fried. Okay, but the stewed okra gets this kind of sliminess to it that a lot of people don't find appealing. I mean, people from Brazil love it and people from the South love it. But if you haven't been raised on it, it can be a little bit creepy. So today we're going to actually have okra that is raw. And we're picking some, look, see this okra here? It looks kind of like a finger. And actually in the Caribbean, they call it ladies' fingers. And what you want to do is to pick them when they're really small. And I like them when they're about an inch long. These purple ones are called burgundy okra, and they're really pretty, too, and they'll be nice in this raw salad. Once you cook them, the color kind of goes a little off. So they're really wonderful, eaten raw. Let me find a few more of these, and it's kind of one of the joys of summer is to go out there and harvest okra. It takes off. You find new ones every day. There's always a few that you've forgotten, and they get too big, and it's always a challenge to stay on top of it.
What happens when they get too big?
They get very fibrous. So you'd really have to stew them a long time to make them edible. So when they're really small and young and tender, actually, why don't you try one of these just right off the plant? Isn't that nice?
Doesn't even need to be deep fried.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's great just like that. So that's how we're going to actually eat them today, is just tossed in kind of a Southern Indiana vinaigrette. And that's it. We've got a nice little handful. It's enough for a couple salads here. So here we go. Simple summer salad. Ingredients that come out of any garden that's of any decent size here in the Midwest. So we have got our tomatoes. I've got several different varieties. I've got some nice golden ones and some red zebra tomatoes. I've got some red onions, some tomatillos, a little bit of garlic chili, and the okra. We can do about equal amounts. So I would say if you have about a cup to a cup and a half of each of those vegetables, that would be fine. And if you like something, put more in. You could add some cucumber if you'd like. So we're just going to add those to the bowl. The tomatoes, the onions, garlic. The garlic is all minced up nice and fine. Now for flavoring, I'm going to put a few chili rings. Now these are that I'm using are cayenne, so they're these little red ones. They're quite spicy, but we're not going to use that many of them. And we're going to add a little lemon zest, which, you know, lemon zest gives you that nice citrusy, zesty taste. Okay, and we're going to finish it with the okra. Now, with the okra, I'm just going to cut them in half lengthwise so you really can see what they are. I'm going to leave the little tops on them because they're so young and tender, you don't need to worry about those being tough or chewy. All right, now we're going to drizzle that with a little bit of honey, probably about a tablespoon. Okay, and then what's important about this salad is that you put the vinegar on, and what the vinegar does is it keeps that kind of filmy, slimy stuff from forming. So it's very important you get that vinegar on early, right after you cut them. Okay, and we're just going to put a touch of olive oil in, a little salt and pepper, freshly ground pepper always. All right, and that's all there is to the salad. You can see it looks almost like carnival time. It's, it's so colorful and vibrant.
It is a beautiful dish, for sure. Check out photos and follow the recipe at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Aobon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, and everyone at Harvest Public Media, Big Red Eats Green, and Traditional Arts Indiana. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thanks for tuning in today, folks. Till next week, I'm Annie Corrigan.